You are listening to the Middle East Institute's podcast series. To support MEI's programs and podcasts, please donate at www.mei.edu. Thank you for your support.
I'm Kate Seeley, Senior Vice President of the Middle East Institute, and I want to welcome you to today's event and thank you all so much for coming out in this incredible cold. I hope you have your hot chocolate, and I hope your toes are warming up. What is so remarkable is that almost all of our panelists made it yesterday through the snow, some from as far away as Doha, Qatar, for today's panel. So I guess this panel was just meant to be, despite the obstacles. One of our panelists got on the 8 a.m. train this morning. She was supposed to take the Acela from New York, which was canceled, and her regional train got stuck in Philly. She should be here in about 35 minutes, so she's on her way. We're really excited about today's event, and we're not the only ones. We had over 220 people register for today. We've sadly lost a few because of the weather, but I think the scale of registration just speaks to how much interest there is in this town in the topic of entrepreneurship, which is such a fresh topic, and how much interest there is in this particular set of voices who are all doing very hands-on work to develop and build entrepreneurial opportunities in Egypt. This panel is part of MEI's Arab Transitions Initiative. It's an initiative to bring fresh voices and insights from the region to reflect on the transitions and transformations underway. And we're trying to bring solutions-oriented analysis and programming to topics like Egypt's economy and hope that today's discussion will increase understanding about different ways to be thinking about growth and opportunity and employment and jobs in Egypt. I think that's what's needed more of in this town, because we tend to get stuck in the old paradigms of how to do things. Our amazing set of panelists from the left, and I'll exclude our moderator for the moment, Dina Sharif, Mona Mawafi, and James Harmon, are working very hard to break the mold of how people have traditionally thought about doing business in Egypt, and they are bringing fresh approaches and new vision to this topic, and I believe with this fresh vision will come new opportunities. Chris will be introducing them later, so I'm not going to say much more other than to thank them deeply for coming. It is a great honor and a privilege to have you here today. But I do want to recognize our moderator, Chris Schroeder, who has single-handedly done more than any other American, I think, to make Americans aware of this incredible boom of entrepreneurship in the region. And he's done so by writing a very, very enlightening book entitled Startup Rising, The Entrepreneurial Revolution, Remaking the Middle East, which if you haven't picked up or read, please go buy it or download it. It's a fabulous overview of the dynamics in the region from Dubai to Egypt with so many new startups and tech ventures taking place. Chris is a former CEO of several e-commerce businesses as well as a venture investor who immersed himself in the world of startups from Dubai to Beirut in order to write his book, and has also been writing about this topic extensively for the Wall Street Journal and the Harvard Business Review and others. I couldn't imagine a better informed moderator on this topic, and so it is with great enthusiasm, excitement, and appreciation, Chris, that I hand this topic over, or rather this panel over to you.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
I couldn't be more honored to be here and to be with you guys in particular, and I want to get to you right away. I just want to frame it in 2 seconds, if I could, overall, because I think a lot, Dina's heard me say this often, but it's something really to think about. There was a great figure in a time of revolution, which was a huge time of disruption, and we sometimes think 20 years later, forget that it was also a time often of despair, and he had a wonderful quote, which is, hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out. The certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out. Some of you will remember it was a great Czech leader, Vaclav Havel, who said that. And I think a great deal about that quote throughout my life in the last 2 years in particular. Because I want to know if you think this makes sense. How would you feel about a country where the internet contributes as much as a percentage of the GDP as its health services, education, and oil industries? Where the internet adoption is growing at nearly twice the rate as it is in Europe, whose growth is driven in large part by growth in private and corporate-backed entrepreneurship, has a population, in fact, the largest population of internet and mobile users in its region, with one of the largest youth populations in the world, is a large consumer market in the very early days of e-commerce, is an enormous global tourist destination where less than 5% of all the travel that has ever been booked there has been booked online. Now, many of my friends, when I talk about this, think I'm describing maybe Germany or China or Brazil. But, of course, because we're here today, you know, I'm describing Egypt. And I haven't even touched on some of the economic strengths of the less tech-centric businesses, which are there, and we almost never see in the news. Obviously, it would be silly to not acknowledge the challenges are there, but they're there. But as you point out so beautifully, Kate, that's typically all we focus on in the United States, and particularly in Washington. I think it is an incredible tribute to the Middle East Institute, for Carnegie for hosting us, but first and foremost, for all you guys for being here today to contemplate other scenarios, because as you're about to find out, they're very real. This is a stunning panel, and I'm thrilled to start with my old friend Dina, who probably has taught me more about startups and entrepreneurship in Egypt throughout the Middle East, has been a leader in corporate social responsibility efforts throughout the region, and is now building a business in that area right now. She has traveled throughout Africa as well as the Middle East, and has been a great friend here in the United States for many, many years, and thinking about the connections here. And Dina, among other things, you gave me what I think was one of my favorite quotes in the book. And that when we were talking about how the technology was changing things and mindsets in Washington and elsewhere, you sort of stopped and paused and said, big institutions think of people as problems. Bottom-up institutions, what technology is unleashing, think of people as assets. Can you talk a little bit about that?
First of all, don't listen to anything Chris says about me. And just as a disclaimer, I have to say I'm very jet-lagged, so if I don't sound as intelligent as I normally sound, I'm hoping you'll forgive me. So I think just on Chris's point, I think oftentimes when we look at this whole youth challenge, the challenge of youth economic empowerment, of youth inclusion, we tend to see it as a problem, and we forget that youth are actually assets with a lot to contribute to the actual, all the many solutions that can be offered to support economic growth within Egypt. So that particular quote, which I to this day can't remember saying to him, was really about how I think there, and it's too bad that Yumna's not here now because she's the perfect example of how youth are taking charge and starting their own businesses that are very socially innovative, that are contributing back to their communities, but also creating jobs and expanding the economy. And I think that's an element that's often missing, where big institutions come in and say, there's this huge problem of youth unemployment, no jobs, but forget to include them as a part of the process and in the solution.
What do you think, in Washington in particular, since this is the audience we have today, that the top-down institutions, and by that I mean big government institutions, NGOs, people really doing God's work in many ways and are thinking about things in very powerful ways, but what do you think that they're missing most now that you're in Egypt, bottom up, that you hope if they remember nothing else, you remember that today?
I think they're missing that things are happening anyway. So I think, you know, there tends to be this, oh, look at Egypt, it's such a mess, it's such a disaster, it's falling apart, it's unstable, there's security issues. But at the same time, and I think, Chris, you're one of the few people who talk about this, a lot of the positive things happening in Egypt, there are youth who are doing things regardless, who are overcoming the obstacles, the challenges. A lot of that is because of the internet and because of access to technology, but they're not waiting for Washington, D.C.
Oh, can you hear me like this? Yeah? Okay. Let me just pull it up.
Flip your collar.
Okay, is this better?
Repeat that answer, though, because it's so important, I think.
So what I was saying is that I think that D.C. just, or policymakers in general, need to recognize that a lot of the youth in Egypt are out there continuing on regardless of what they say or do. So.
But could you give just one of the most obvious examples that jump out that you see at scale at Cairo and elsewhere that you bet most of your friends here and just people who are here for the first time aren't really focusing on because they're focusing on the more typical, what I'll call CNN narrative?
Well, look at all the incubators and accelerators that are coming up to support young entrepreneurs.
Go slowly. I bet you a lot of people don't know about it.
One of them started by your close friend, Flat Six Labs, Ahmed Arfi. There's Ahead of the Curve. There's Silatech doing a lot of work for youth in Egypt. There I think there's a growing community of young entrepreneurs who are really supporting each other, guiding each other with how to get access to capital, training, capacity building. Ahmed Alfi, who is the founder of Flat Six Labs, which is a tech startup incubator, created something called a technology park, which I think many people haven't realized is happening anyway, regardless of the instability, regardless of the security issues, regardless of the transition, took the old American University in Cairo campus and is turning this into what he hopes will be a mini Silicon Valley. So I think there's a lot happening on the ground that people aren't talking about, that very positive things that exist to support youth entrepreneurship in Egypt, and I think that's what people should focus on as opposed to the constant discussions of security, democratic reform. That's going to happen anyway. So I think the focus should go towards these young people who are trying to start their own businesses to create the jobs that they need because they're not getting it from the government. And so they're out there trying to fix this problem themselves.
Alfi's shared workspace, by the way, is the largest in the entire Middle East, including Istanbul now. And it's a baseball throw away from Tahrir Square. So this is an amazing kind of phenomenon. Mona Mouafi, you've dedicated your life to public health, which is obviously an enormous issue in Egypt as well in the Middle East, but you've also founded Rise Egypt, which I think is one of the more exciting things that's happening right now. Could you tell us a little bit about it and why now?
Sure, and thank you for having me here. I think that it's a timely discussion. I was reflecting this morning. I have a feeling you probably can't hear me in the back. I'm just going to hold this. I was reflecting this morning on the fact that we're just a few days away from Martin Luther King holiday, and having been born and raised here in D.C. area, and thinking about how the revolution itself was kicked off, and sort of what led to it, I was thinking about labor movements and opportunity and economic justice. And I think to frame the discussion a little bit around what you were saying, you know, we often forget in the turmoil of sort of the political ups and downs and churnings of constitutional referendums and elections and ideological debates that a lot of what drove this was economic injustice and strikes that took place back, all the way back in 2008 in Mahalla, you know, outside of Cairo, where it was essentially a strike that was co-organized by some garment workers and those who were willing to help them get attention. And at the time, it was a revolution to be using Facebook to organize, and it was happening under the radar. And the reality is that these people are still fighting for economic justice. And of course, the revolution has taken on many forms and, you know, there have been many ideological debates. But Rise Egypt, to come to your question, Chris, is really about focusing keeping a laser focus on issues of economic justice, economic and social development in the country. And so a group of us back in 2011 had, based in Boston, Egyptian-Americans, mostly from Harvard and MIT grads, young professionals, sort of said, what can we do to help? Which is, I think, a question a lot of people were asking. And at the time, we decided we wanted to move ideas to action. We did not want to just have a conference. And long story short, a group of us developed something called the NIGMA Conference and Social Innovation. We called it Impact Egypt Competition. And this was sort of a test run for this concept of mobilizing the Egyptian diaspora and our networks, so Friends of Egypt, Americans, others who want to help and assist in this way, to really focus on particular ideas, not just pie in the sky, but here are people, here are actual entrepreneurs who are trying to make change on the ground. How can we assist them? And so we started thinking about the role that we play as Egyptians abroad, or, you know, those of us who are first generation, second generation, in being bridge builders between Egypt and the world. And so essentially what Rise Egypt and Rise stands for, realizing innovation through social entrepreneurship. And we were recently incorporated this summer, so our website will be up soon, and we'll get lots of information out to you, hopefully. The Rise Egypt is really now will be a full-blown think and do tank to mobilize the global Egyptian diaspora and its networks to invest in entrepreneurship for development in the country. And
can you talk a little bit, what do you think is the difference between entrepreneurship, and let's get definitional here for a second, because I think different, when one uses the word entrepreneurship, I find they're 100 100 different definitions for it. How do you think about entrepreneurship, and do you make a distinction in your mind between entrepreneurship and social entrepreneurship?
Yes, I do. I think in general, social entrepreneurship is really focused on business development that has community, social, and cultural environmental returns. And so it's the idea of utilizing the private sector and sort of business principles for development outcomes. And what we noticed in doing, we made several trips over several years to do needs assessments and frankly just ask people on the ground, what do you need? We didn't want to assume anything. And we would ask them, what do you need? You know, what's missing? How can we help, essentially, given the skill sets that we have and the resources that we have access to? And what we heard over and again was skills building, mentorship, advice, capacity building, learning partnerships, access to information. All of those sorts of things came number one, and access to capital came number two. And that was consistently. I mean, literally 95% of the people said that. And so, obviously, it wasn't that I have a PhD, and so science is important for me. It was not a representative sample of all entrepreneurs in Egypt, but then again, it was what it was. And so we started to think there is real traction here, and people are doing really interesting things to develop their own community. So as far as this difference between entrepreneurship and social entrepreneurship, I think a lot of businesses develop, you know, that have a bottom line of financial return. And social entrepreneurs are really, yes, interested in financial return, but their motivation is development. And that, and Rise Egypt is focused on supporting those entrepreneurs.
So one more with you. I'm curious. I mean, you dropped the H-bomb, right? I mean, one of the things that I hear a lot is that this tends to be an elite phenomenon, both within country, and then it's a bunch of Harvard, Ivy League grads who've come back who feel really warm and fuzzy about everything. But if we look at the revolution as it started 2 years ago and we look from it now, you know, the news we all see here is, first of all, not positive. And then secondly, there is this sort of instinctive reaction that this entrepreneurship stuff, this social entrepreneurship stuff, is sort of this elite-y kind of a thing. I haven't seen that at all, but I'm curious what you thought.
Well, okay. In truth, I think there's probably some of that on some level, but I would not at all characterize the majority of entrepreneurs or social entrepreneurs as elite. In fact, what Rise is really committed to as well is expanding the ecosystem of social entrepreneurship in the country and thinking about how we can get A, outside of Cairo, and B, outside of the sort of educated elite. And that's one thing that we did, was the lessons learned from NGMA, from the NGMA competition that we had, was as soon as you have a competition that is in English, based at MIT, and as a call for proposals based on for social entrepreneurs, you are by definition getting people who speak English, understand what social entrepreneurship is, and have the confidence and willingness to come all the way to MIT to compete. So we were getting a lot of the elite from Cairo. And what we've decided with Rise, and who are well-deserving, by the way, as well, of support and in need of the support. But what we want to do with Rise is support, yes, those people, but also and get on the ground and think creatively about how we can identify other social entrepreneurs across the country, in other governorates, in the villages, who have very interesting ideas. And I, you know, off the top of my head, I can think of a few. Recyclopikia, for example, is one from Tanta. They're from Tanta. They're basically taking, you know, e-waste from companies, and recycling it and, you know, making a profit off of it. And this, they started in 2011. Supported by INGES, which is another one of the important actors on the ground, with some simple business development, basically no capital startup, and they're doing very well now, and they're exporting, you know, they're really scaling, and there are others like them, and as part of some of the trips that we were taking, you know, we found just sitting in back alleys and in Tahrir and listening to stories that there were people who actually had no education that were coming up with very interesting entrepreneurial ideas and just needed some level of support.
I saw through it. I remember when I interviewed the head of Google Egypt, that did one of the first great startup competitions in the region, let alone in Egypt. They actually rented a bus and drove all over the country to instill people to come and compete in the competition, and got thousands from outside of Cairo, and he was stunned by the caliber of drive and innovation and problem solving he saw in every corner. And I think that's absolutely crucial overall. Jim, I want to turn to you because Jim Harmon is, in a way you don't exist anymore. I mean, you're one of the definitions of the great public servants in my view, because you've had an amazing career in the private sector. You're one of the most well-regarded investors in emerging growth markets, generally speaking, but you served in the Clinton administration in running the IDB. You now are running the Egypt Enterprise Fund, so you've had this amazing mix between using your expertise and bringing it to bear not only for our country, I think, but for the world overall. But you are a hard-nosed businessman. You know what returns are all about. You know how tough the world can be. You've got no illusion of almost anyone that I've ever met. And I'm just sort of curious, could you first describe, one, what the Egypt Enterprise Fund is to folks here and why you think it matters from that lens?
Okay, thank you, Chris. Can you hear me in the back?
I think you have to push it up, lift it up.
I'll move it like this. First, I would like to thank the Mideast Institute for organizing this. I was surprised when I first heard the number of people who would even register to come here. In New York City, it would be maybe a quarter of that, unfortunately. Secondly, I'm surprised the number of people who showed up in the kind of conditions. So I thank all the people who are here, which gives me some reason to be more hopeful, to come back to your point, about support for Egypt, and I'm grateful, as I said, for you, Kate, and for all the work that was done on it, and for the panelists who struggled a little bit more. Although last night, coming in the train, when the train finally got stuck, I thought to myself, probably I would have been smarter if I did, but you might have come in this morning, but I didn't get it. Thank goodness. Okay, so maybe one other comment. I think Chris Schroeder has done a great deal for all the things that we all care about, and that is to present the reasons why there are so many opportunities in the Middle East in the entrepreneurial area. And I think that it's no surprise that a lot of people became very interested in the book and a lot of people became interested in what he had to say, because that was a vacuum. People didn't know it. It was very important new information. So now I'll come back to, by the way, I am an optimist, but I'm also hopeful. So I'm both. Maybe one bit of background. So I spent my lifetime in the U.S. financial community as an investment banker. I ran something called Schroeder Wertheim, and then I got tapped to be the chairman of the Exim Bank. I highly recommend anybody here that getting repotted into the public sector or into the private sector is an enormously growing experience. So for those of you who've stayed doing the same thing for your whole life, even those in the think tank, I should say, something different is very valuable. And at my age, to be running the Exim Bank, it was an extraordinary experience for me, and I'm grateful for the 4 years. When I got out, it was clear to me that the opportunities in the so-called developing world, in the frontier developing world, which are the countries where there's the greatest risk, and even in those countries going through the most difficult time, it was an enormous opportunity. And so I formed a fund mostly to try to help the flow of capital into the poorest parts of the world. Little did I know that the returns that we would have would far exceed anything I imagined, and it became an enormously important and good business. For those people who say to me, did you really want to make more money than you already had? I said, I didn't do it for that reason. I'm glad that all the people who now work in the fund are doing so well, but most of all, it was to show people you could have good returns in the higher risk countries, including the whole Middle East. So we invest in Pakistan, you'd be surprised to know, in Zimbabwe, in Lebanon, and we have shown an average return for our fund over 9 years of a little better than 17% per annum. Today, the institutions wouldn't talk to us 8 or 9 years ago because they didn't want to go back to their committee to tell them that this fund created by this man, Harmon, actually invested in the countries I just told you about. So no one would invest, only families invested. Now institutions are coming to us in large numbers, so we've actually had to close the fund temporarily to new investment. Every major university, it seems to me, and foundation is now interested to invest in what we all call the frontier world, which includes the whole of the Middle East. It's a great story here in that, yes, we started off doing something good, but it turned out to be something very profitable for the investors and everybody else. What does that mean? That really comes back to Chris's question. That means that one of the bottom lines is where there is stability, where there is political stability, there is economic stability and economic opportunity. So that we could show returns, however, even in countries like Pakistan during the most difficult times, does tell you that there are opportunities in all of these countries. Now, Egypt, the Egyptian American Enterprise Fund, I rue the day, I think, that the Secretary of State asked me first to take this position because I didn't really know it would take as long as we would take to where we are today. But I'm
delighted that I did it. And we have created a very important board of directors. Under the legislation, it has to have 3 Egyptian citizens and 6 American citizens, and we decided to have 3 Egyptian citizens and 3 Egyptian Americans and 3 Egyptians, which made the various different Egyptian governments that I've had to deal with in the last 3 years all very, very pleased. Of course, no one told me there would be a number of governments there, and no one told me, I should have known this from my Ex-Im Bank years, that certain members of the House of Representatives, certain members of the Senate had strong feelings about what we were doing. So I have now testified before brief committees, I don't know how many times. It has to be at least 15 times. So more of my time has been spent working with our Congress. But I'll fast forward to say to you that today, even those members who had the greatest reservations about, they were on the other side of the aisle, about the administration and what they were doing in the Egyptian policy and what the enterprise fund was, have become believers now and very supportive. So we have a great deal of support, and that has meant that we now have the funding to really start. So we now have $120 million, and I expect we'll have the next $60 million sometime in the next few months. So the original concept was a $300 million fund, and the fund was to be a partnership between the private sector, which I represent, and the public sector funding initially. And we looked at the enterprise funds that were formed after, early 1990s, the so-called enterprise funds in Eastern Europe, which were quite successful. Credit to USAID for doing the very good job they did. And if you look at the model, it's different than Egypt because those funds were to help countries that were transitioning from the communist world to the private sector. That meant they had no publicly traded markets and no stock markets. It was a different kind of challenge for those enterprise funds. But they did reasonably well. And when I read the history and talked to former chairman, I realized it was a very good idea that this administration had to create an enterprise fund for Egypt and for Tunisia. And they decided it should be in an aggregate of $300 million, $60 million a year for 5 years. It's not easy sometimes when you have the kind of changes to do what we're going to do, but it worked sufficiently well in Eastern Europe, and even though Egypt was different because Egypt had a sophisticated stock market already and some private equity people already, but we went over, and I have now made a number of trips to Egypt to study this. We finally got our funding. We created a board, which is very enthusiastic about it, and we're about to make our first investment. And now, for the first time, other countries are talking to us about possibly joining us. Wouldn't it be nice if this would be a new model for the enterprise funds of the future? Someday we will have an enterprise fund in Afghanistan. Someday we will be an enterprise fund in Syria. Key now is to try to get other countries, in my mind, to join with us on investments that we make or in the fund itself. That would be, therefore, we would have a consortium. So it's not just the U.S. going into Egypt to try to make a profit. But in fact, it's an Arab, European, U.S. effort, which is goal is to obviously try to show reasonable returns, but also to help create jobs in Egypt. And probably everybody here knows that you have the largest Arab country in population, 90 million people, $225 billion in GDP. But very little money has been invested in Egypt in the last 3 years. Just to give you one illustration, last year there were 140,000 cars sold in Egypt. A reference point, in Algeria last year, 400,000 cars were sold. For those of you who try to travel around Cairo, you might think that's a good thing that they haven't sold more cars. That's a separate problem about what we should do about urban transport, which I think we can do something about. But it just tells you that there's very little infrastructure investment that's been made in Egypt the last 3 years. And the reason I'm optimistic is that if you take a country, the stock market in Egypt has gone up 45% since June 30th, since the so-called coup. 45%. And people ask me, what is the country that my day job has done the best in the last year? They're shocked to hear that our returns, buying marketable shares, is greater in Egypt than any other country in the world that we've had over in the last 12 months. So if you look at the returns and you look at the opportunities you have there, and then you factor in that there's been so little investment made in the infrastructure. So now, if we can bring private funds in to invest in the infrastructure and to invest in building Egypt, the investors will get very good returns, and it will result in a significant, in my opinion, injection of new job creation. 50% of the population is under the age of 30. I think that of that portion, I believe the unemployment rate is bigger than what is generally disclosed. I think it's probably a third that's unemployed. So you have a very big number here. And we've all been involved with job creation in a lot of other countries. In the last 10 years, I have watched this job creation opportunities in a number of frontier countries. So this is not rocket scientist work. This can be done. So what do we have? I hope there will be a new president with reasonable leadership and a new cabinet. Then some decisions we made. If it is Sisi, for example, I think he has the military and the police behind him and the business sector too. He could address the critical subsidy issues, which are so important. My guess is it can be, that again is not any great mystery. We all know how you could go about doing that. So one could conclude that with the little kind of return we got, or the return in their stock market. By the way, the stock market represents only a number like 25% of the GDP. That's a very low number when you take the market value of all the publicly owned companies. That number is modest compared to most of the developing and frontier countries. When that number grows, which it will, it will attract a lot more money. I don't want to go on too long.
No, it's very interesting. Let me just, if I could just dig deep on particular sectors for people to think about. You and I were sitting here 20 years ago, the conventional wisdom about the global economy was Japan's going to win it all. China could not possibly grow without Jeffersonian democracy. And India was a disaster because there were riots going on all the time. And 5 years later, no one is saying any of that. 5 years from now, when we're sitting here, what are two or three things that you think we have the potential to be saying about Egypt that maybe we're not thinking about in the right lens by looking maybe backwards instead of forwards?
5 years from now, people will say, why didn't we invest in Egypt when Chris Schroeder said there was opportunities there? I'm optimistic, not hopeful, optimistic that will happen. We have seen that happen over and over again. Egypt has a lot of assets here, excellent human capital, enormous growth potential. We can go step by step. There's not enough
time. Two examples of the ones that you're just most excited about.
But I gave one already. To take the automobile market, if we were to do what we have done in other cities and redirect traffic patterns and bring in hybrid buses, and we could improve the traffic flow and reduce accidents in Cairo very significantly. Now, we went with a plan. The World Bank and the World Resources Institute went with a plan to the former government, but President Morsi, even his transportation minister, was very interested. We couldn't get it done. We will get that done. So if you try to improve traffic flows and you bring in new forms of transportation, we will improve the quality of life for the residents. And the same thing could be said in recycling. The same thing could be said in healthcare. The same thing could be said in I could go on and on and on. Infrastructure opportunities here are enormous, and there is funding available. So for those here, maybe if there's one message I would say, those here say, but we don't have the money to do it, we don't know how to get it, there is money available. Witness the kind of flow of funds that came into the stock market, and it's not just the enterprise fund. Yes, the enterprise fund can play a role as a catalyst and bring in other countries. And this little enterprise fund, which started out with $60 million a year, will be $300 million. It's not impossible that with other countries that we could have $1 billion, but the amount that could come in from other sources is very significant. So I'm convinced that 5 years from now, you'll look back. Now, I haven't even touched on your subject and others on the panel.
So I'm going to turn to that right now, if I could. But just a little bit on kind of the background infrastructure, because you have all touched on, and he touched on, the youth bubble, which obviously at one level is a wonderful thing. Right? In some respects, I'd rather that problem than Japan's problem with an aging population. But we also know the darker side of that. And I want to start, Mona, with you, and then Dina, ask you the same question about this. Is the infrastructure state to get to the future that you've all been talking about, and Jim just outlined, the education infrastructure is not in good shape. There's There's lots of things that are tough for this new generation, and I'm wondering how you think about the confluence of taking advantage of the opportunity that may be coming, but also a new generation that must be prepared for that advantage.
Absolutely, and I think that Jim touched on some incredibly important points, and I think that there are certain areas that I've definitely seen come up over and again. One of them in this area of recycling and the environment and solar and alternative energy, and so I'm looking forward to, and hopefully Yumna will get here in time. The other is in this issue of education. Not enough schools can actually be built, and not enough teachers are already trained to handle just population growth.
Well,
at this
screwed,
point.
Then? I mean, how are you?
Well, we're not screwed in the sense that at the same time on the ground, again, I think that, well, not I think that, what I'm seeing is that there are a number of SMEs, small, medium enterprises that are basically trying to fill this gap. And so they see that. People see that in their local communities. One of the teams that we're supporting, they were just here in November for an acceleration program, was a group called Educate Me, which is basically trying to build, they are working on what is an equivalent of a charter school system, student-driven learning, experiential learning, and they're not trying to be pie in the sky again, alternative model. They're really trying to also map what they're doing with the national curriculum so that they can get their students to pass exams, but in a way that in the end the kids end up getting more educated. And so we think about how can we train groups like these, enterprises like these, to measure social impact and the impact that they're having, not just on the education of the students, but also on development at the community level. And in terms of poverty alleviation and whatnot, and how much are they able to fill this gap, and can they be scaled to start to fill this niche?
You mentioned in passing earlier InJazz. Could you tell folks what that is?
So InJazz is an organization, among others, their Endeavor, Ashoka, Nahdat Mahroosa. There are several actors on the ground now that are essentially working on the capacity building, identifying entrepreneurs in Egypt and in other countries.
High school, though, right? Kids, education.
That's true. InJazz, and I'm actually not so familiar with InJazz's program in detail. Maybe Dina can speak to it more in detail. But they are essentially there are many organizations trying to create a pipeline right now of support to get kids and eventually going through college and graduates to think about innovation and how to fill the gaps around education otherwise. And Dina, if you want to speak to InJazz in particular.
And the kids just generally. The infrastructure education is an issue that I hear about all the time, and yet things are happening. So can you talk a little bit about it?
I'm actually going to say something different than Mona about this issue of education, because I think it's true that not enough schools exist, not enough training, or not enough teachers are being trained. But I actually think the biggest problem is the way they're being taught. So I think education reform is so critical at the school level and at the level of higher education that we can't forget about, no matter how many schools we build or how many teachers we train, if we continue teaching our youth the same way we've been doing it for decades.
Meaning what?
Meaning we have a system of rote learning. There's no creativity, no innovation. Our youth are not taught to be creative and innovative. I think the ones that end up following that path are the exception, not necessarily the rule. And I think that it's very important to focus on higher education and school and using different pedagogies of teaching that I think is often neglected. So Silitec, for example, is now focused on civic engagement, using civic engagement on university campuses to unleash that creativity. So as you get young people to focus on problem solving, that creativity and innovation will come. And I think these are things that we often forget about.
Go ahead, please.
Quickly to piggyback on that, I think that's why Educate Me and other initiatives like Fab Lab are also trying to educate around innovation and sort of utilizing creativity and experiential learning in problem solving and acquiring the regular curriculum. So that's, I think, why it's important to map sort of the knowledge basis that the curriculum offers with the process learning that we so often associate with other learning.
So I'm going to be the controversial devil's advocate, because I love Educate Me, and there are a lot of examples of people who created things like Educate Me. There's Tawassul, Chris, you've been to Azbit Khair Allah, an NGO that started a one classroom school that is very much based on experiential learning. But these are small initiatives that will never go to scale as long as they stay locked into this non-profit NGO heavily dependent on donor funding to exist.
So maybe 15% of the startups I saw in Egypt alone were using technology to come at the education issue. So NAFAM, which is a Flat 6 Lab spinoff, is a little bit like Khan Academy. It's an Arabic version of just people downloading videos within the curriculum constraints of what is in Egypt right now. Now almost 15,000 videos have been uploaded in the last 8 months. Over 2 million Egyptians have pulled down videos of education there. Do you think there's some, I mean, what the young people tell me is that we're going to hack the system. How hopeful are you for that as an addition? I don't think it's going to solve everything.
I think NAFAM is about accessibility. It's just, it's another layer. I think what has been done with NAFAM is that they've given, so school in Egypt, I don't know if everybody knows, but private lessons are a big problem for those who send their kids to school, and it's not something that we can easily afford. So NAFAM is about accessibility, and I think they're providing many families with another tool to access what they would learn in school. So instead of taking private lessons, you can go to NAFAM and download a video. So I think that's a great support for education. I don't think it's solving the education problem, which is really how we teach our kids, but I think it has potential to do so as they start including videos that are a bit alternative in scope.
Jim, as you listen to this conversation and think about the infrastructure opportunities as well as the challenges come going forward, if you could wave your hand and get the international community as well as the U.S. community to do more for the kinds of things that we're hearing that are coming bottom up, what would you hope that they do first and foremost? If you could literally just make it happen, are there two or three things that you really would like to see that could put some jet fuel into what's happening anyway?
I think the Egyptian people control largely the answer to the question. If we have... yes, I said I think the Egyptian people not only make are the determining factor on what will happen, and that is as it should be. We can't go in, we the United States especially, but even the Europeans, and go in and tell Egypt how they should go about changing various different things. So what should the Egyptian people do? Well, I'm hoping that they will have an election which will elect a president who can address some of the critical issues, like the subsidy issue, which I said. The Egyptians have to get their fiscal house in order. But the market already has said that they're going to do it. So there is this enormous increase in prices, and there has been a wealth created, unfortunately only by those who could invest there, mostly families who had the funding. The trick now is, to come back to a phrase before, is to scale it up. How do we scale up an effort by outside countries which will create jobs? Because the first thing is, if you do create jobs, then everything changes. When people have work, I don't have to tell this audience how important it is to have jobs in a country like Egypt or in a country like the United States. Then reforms will come. And as reforms will come, there will be opportunities for women, opportunities for minority, and we will achieve a great deal long term. But the first step, as I come back to it, some kind of a reasonable election, which I expect to happen. The second step is to clearly have ministers in place who could make decisions. There have been very little decisions made in the last 3 years. And as those decisions are made and subsidy issues and others like that take place, then you could have things done on education, things done on health care. But during the last 3 years, so little has been invested in that area. So we come back to what Chris started with. Well, fortunately, he would say, I think, that the private sector in the venture capital area started. But the private sector in the venture capital is a slow grind it out at first, because it can't make the, I mean, in the United States, it could make a difference when Google is formed and all, but in the developing countries, you need the help of the government itself and other governments to move it along. So I'm convinced we're heading there now. We're going to head there because Egypt got lucky, in my judgment, and in that it will have leadership, and it will make the kinds of adjustments, and that will lead to a continuous flow of funds, and you will have
all sorts of capable people who will help Egypt address the issues. So I'm less concerned about, if you have stability, I'm less concerned about who's going to make the changes. I am convinced that with a little bit of effort, we could redirect the traffic flow in Cairo, and we could reduce the carbon emitted in the country, in the cities, and we could help that, as it's been done in Mexico City, as it was done in Shanghai, it's now been done in Istanbul, it's been done in 80 cities in Brazil and in Mexico, so it can be done in Egypt. Recycling, another area, obviously, you've got to have important recycling effort. Healthcare, agriculture, and so forth and so on. I think it's all there, but you need what I've said already, stability, and you need leadership, and then the funding will come. So there isn't one thing, except if the Egyptian government moves in the right direction.
The rest will follow.
The rest will follow.
Dina?
I don't know that I fully agree with that. I think stability is important, leadership is important, but they're really significant things missing from the ecosystem. So I think entrepreneurship is, it's hope, and I think why so many of us focus on entrepreneurship is because there is so much hope in that space. But there are things that I think we need to keep in mind. I mean, I think less than 4% of loans go to SMEs in the Middle East, including Egypt. That is such a tiny amount when compared to other areas in the world. And also when you go and speak to banks, specifically in Egypt, they'll tell you startups aren't bankable. New enterprise not bankable. They have no interest.
But banks never fund startups anywhere.
That's true. So
but
I
also
think,
don't lose that. This is not a banking phenomenon.
No, it's
Silicon Valley was not built on banks. I mean, it's not a banking. That's not where banks
that
should play.
That same mentality then goes to investors. It goes to angel investors who are not willing to take risk. We don't like risk. So that's another part of our culture that we can't forget. Arabs are not risk takers. They tend to want to go the safe path. So I've found that with enterprises that ahead of the curve has been looking at lately that are very much social enterprises, we get a lot of pushback saying, well, that's a huge risk for us. We're not going to see the return until 5-10 years from now because they're focused on fixing major social challenges. So I think the thing that needs to be focused on is educating the investors. So a lot of the private sector. So there are great people. There are the Fadi Andour, there are the Ahmed Alfis, there's Christopher Schroeder, there's James Harmon. But, you know, there's a lot that we need to do, and I think Mona's doing it as well through Rise Egypt by educating people about how much impact they can have by supporting startups. But I still think that there's a lot more that we need to focus on in terms of educating the investors and those who can actually invest in startups. And I think the worst thing we can do is to have a heavy dependence on the United States and other European countries. We need to be raising money from the inside because there are resources in Egypt and in the Middle East that we need to use.
I'm going to open it to questions in a second, but Mona, I'd love your reaction to that.
So many things just popped into my head. One, as far as raising funds locally, in 2005, which now is almost a decade ago, which is crazy, a landmark study was done, which I'm sure you are also working on and familiar with, on philanthropy in Egypt that showed that $1 billion was given by Egyptians to Egyptians in Egypt, 90% of which was straight charity. So there's a huge opportunity for investment, even domestically. If we can educate the general population about the return on investment in terms of sustainable development, people's lives will be improved in terms of quality, in terms of education, health, better environment, whatnot. So that, again, is a huge opportunity. Yes, Yumna's here, so she'll be able to speak about her enterprise. But secondly, I also wanted to comment on Dina's reaction to the fact that, you know, there are a lot of nonprofits in this space, claiming to be social entrepreneurs and so, or leading social enterprises. And this is a controversial area, not just in Egypt, but globally. Can you be a nonprofit social enterprise? Does an enterprise have to be for profit? And, you know, people have different answers on this. What I've learned, even working with the NGMA winners, and now, you know, in Rise Egypt, is that there's a lot of of education and capacity building that needs to be done, even with people who are self-identified social entrepreneurs. And I very much feel in the middle of this space as somebody who came to entrepreneurship from development, because the development world and people who quote-unquote care about the social good often feel bad about money. You know, they almost feel like it's a, you know, dirty thing. It was a journey for me to come to the private sector because I learned how much more efficient and how to scale some of these social impact interventions, you know, in my world they're called interventions, but in entrepreneurship they're enterprises, can be. And how we can really merge these worlds of global development and social economic development and entrepreneurship. It's a game of translations. That's what I've noticed, sort of living at the intersection. And I think that we're expecting a lot, frankly, of people to get there on their own. And so I totally agree with you that the nonprofit world in Egypt has a lot of work to do. And I think a lot of these quote-unquote social entrepreneurs who are operating as nonprofits currently would be open to operating as for-profits with a little more education and understanding about how to do so. And so I think there needs to be a path.
I think there is a growing trend. Sorry, Chris.
No, go.
I think there is a growing trend right now. There's a study that, and Mona, you know this study is happening on trends in responsible business practice and social entrepreneurship in 7 Arab countries. In Egypt in particular, what we've found is that a lot of youth will say, I'm not interested in starting an NGO anymore. I want to start a business because, A, I want to make money. Mm-hmm. B, I want to create jobs. The government isn't doing it for me. The private sector isn't providing enough jobs. So I'm going to go out and start my own business. But what's happening is that there's this merging of civic engagement and entrepreneurship, specifically post-2011, where a lot of young people are saying, I don't want to create a business. I want to create a business with a purpose. So I think we've seen a lot of new businesses that are developing business models around major challenges within society, whether that be traffic, whether that be environmental, whether that be cultural. And I think Yumna's here and can talk about Karm Solar. They're a great example of a social business that is working on a business.
It's a perfect way and to get to you. Just quickly, Kate, there are some amazing studies that have come out in the last 6 to 9 months these guys know about better than anyone, and it might be great to get links on your website and also people can find them because they are awesome, and it's amazing data now that's available to this one as well. You know, Yuna Madi, I'm so psyched to see you, I can't tell you. And by the way, whenever anyone comes to me and says, you know, they talk about the infrastructure challenges in Egypt,
yeah,
I always answer with one word, and that word is Amtrak. So thank God, goodness that you're here notwithstanding.
Yes.
And thank you for your heroic effort to get here. I don't know how many of you know that literally the largest aquifer of fresh water on earth is under the Egyptian desert. Did you know that? If you didn't, she knows it, and her company knows it, because you are revolutionizing not only alternative energy there, but I think the entire agribusiness, and I think at some point that you're going to be getting people off the grid and doing really interesting things with renewable energies in a way that I think most of us don't think of Egypt leading the way. And so with that, can you please tell us a little bit about Karm Solar and a little bit about you?
Well, Amtrak made me feel like home. I felt like I was in Egypt right now. But put that aside. I'll tell you very quickly about Karm Solar. Karm Solar is a startup company that was established in 2011. The purpose, the reason we were established, we were trying to develop a solar solution that will enable us to power large pumps that are used to lift water from deep wells. We noticed that in Egypt and a lot of the Middle East countries, that majority of agriculture expansion occurs in off-grid locations in the desert, where there's access to aquifers that are very deep, and they're very far away from the electricity grid, so they rely on diesel generators for all their energy. So we wanted to offer a solution, and we knew that we could offer a solution, and we were actually working on this with a partner in the U.S., a solution that could actually compete with diesel generators. Our challenge was that diesel in Egypt and the Middle East is subsidized. And so it's very important for us that we do not rely on the government. We do not want to develop a company, a solar energy company that relies on grant financing, so we had to beat that challenge, and we actually ended up developing a solution and implementing the MENA region's first high-capacity solar pumping solution, which is actually cost-competitive with subsidized diesel in Egypt, so it is actually very competitive in other markets. And from that, actually, we also ventured into another market, which is the tourism sector. Right now, we also offer solar building solutions. There's a unique method towards our buildings, and also it is a commercial solution. So these are our flagship products. And
Give us a case study. Talk about one of the ones that you've actually got on the ground. Mm-hmm. Even in Sudan, I know you had one of your first tests in farming, but in Egypt as well. And just walk us through this dynamic. If I were a farmer, mm-hmm. why is this a better idea than relying on diesel, for example, and what mm-hmm. might this mean to my farm on an ongoing basis?
So when we started in 2011, we worked heavily on research and development, and we tested our solution. We did a lab test, and we won the Wharton Innovation Award. But still, when we were approaching farmers, it was very difficult for us to convince them that this solution would work or have them be the first people to try our solution. So it took us at least 2 years for us to get our first project, and we found a client that was willing to be the first believer, the one that would take the risk and implement the solution. So we implemented a 50-kilowatt solution powering a 30-kilowatt pump. Forget the technicalities. I'm not even an engineer, but anyways. And it worked. Our pump was working. It's pumping water very well. And because it was working very well, the client removed his diesel generator. And from then, we actually were signed as a contract at not seven times the size, but we did one well, and now we're doing seven wells. So this just shows that the technology works. The problem with diesel, it is cheap in Egypt. However, the problem is not about the cost, it's about the reliability. It's not readily available, and a lot of these farms are far away in the desert, so until they get their supply, if they don't get their supply for one day, they lose a whole season of crops. And we're talking about large agribusinesses that are they're one of the largest exporters of potatoes worldwide, and so one day of not having diesel, even though they have backup, but it's very costly. And actually from there, we also built our office in the Western Desert to be close to where our clients are. And we built it using a unique methodology where we use natural earth material and we integrated it with solar solution. From that, one of the clients saw this and wanted us to construct a whole workers' village for his farm. And this is how our new product came to being.
Can you talk about how you fit into the, we talked a lot before you were here mm-hmm. about kind of the rise of entrepreneurship, some skepticism, how big or how serious mm-hmm. or how impactful it can be, or is it just a nice thing people like to point to? But I think you know better than anyone where this potential broader that you fit into might have. And could you just talk about your view of the broader ecosystem of that?
I think Karm Solar, in regards to the Middle East and startup companies, is a unique, it's a unique company, because generally speaking, I think most of startups in the Middle East are centered around software development or e-commerce. Our company is a bit different because it relies heavily on research and development, and it's relatively capital intensive. And so our experiences and our challenges are different, but so we're able to add this to the ecosystem, to the startup ecosystem, show a different type of experience for startups. And let you were talking about social impact. I think social impact of our solutions is very visible. So when we have a project and we just put it on Facebook, the amount of likes and like excitement that we get is big, because in the Middle East, the past 3 years, you're hearing a lot of things about political instability and just a lot of depressing things. So sometimes when you see a solar energy project that is commercial, that's creating jobs, it's very exciting, and it makes entrepreneurs, or creates a lot of entrepreneur spirits, I feel.
We have a great opportunity for you guys to ask questions. Well, I'm going to cold call first, if I could, Mike Ducker, just because you guys don't know him, but he worked as a consultant to USAID through all the revolutions in Egypt. And whenever I ask about Americans who've been helpful in the environment of the ecosystem there, his name has come up. But what's interesting is you can compare what's happening in Egypt to other frontier markets, and I think you think it comes out quite favorably. And I wonder if you could just share one or two thoughts before we open it up to other people.
Hello?
Yeah.
Sure. Thanks, Chris. I will stand up because I'm so short. I'll give you two thoughts. One is, actually, USAID asked me to design a program in 2010. And one of the things they asked me, you know, what do you think? And like was said, well, Egyptians are risk adverse. They're risk adverse. And then the revolution happened, and you see people sleeping on tanks in front of guns, in front of army, and you're like, are they really risk adverse? So I had to rethink that concept once I heard that, because the revolution changed that, and I think that the answer is that there's a generation that is not risk adverse, that is coming up, that has grown up on the internet, as you well document in your book. The second point is that the entrepreneurship in the ecosystem development is as much of a journey as possible. And Egypt, though I compare it favorably against other countries I've visited in the ecosystem development, you don't say there's angel investment. There's been more angel investment in Egypt than I've seen in other countries in Latin America and Vietnam and in other places in the world that I've just recently visited. They're ahead in many different aspects, but there's so much far to go. I mean, it's an incredible journey. Many of the entrepreneurs that you highlight in your book are actually struggling right now for many different reasons. It's not an easy process. And I will make a third point that it was created not because of the government. It was created because I think five or six people. We talked about Alfie, but there's four other ones that have just made an incredible effort. They're champions. They're, people who wanted to make a difference and made a difference, and built up the ecosystem. And because of that, created excitement. And without those four or five people, and I have a hard time finding them in other countries sometimes. Without those champions, and you highlighted some of the champions in your book, you can't have an ecosystem. So I'll just say that.
Thank you. Sir.
My name is Amin Mahmoud. I'd like to ask Mona about the example of Jawad Nabulsi and Nibni. He's been working since Mubarak time. He's facing a lot of problem until today. Even he have the fund, but to take old hospital and so on. How you see your projects or future comparing to that? He's, and you know about him. Mm-hmm. That's the question. And for Jim, you optimistic. I'm naturally optimistic, but not in the situation we have in Egypt right now. I don't want to go in politics, but we have a system built on a water will fail soon. Then I don't know where we are going from there.
Mona, then Jim.
Sure. So I don't want to speak for Jawad, so I will try to avoid doing that as much as possible. What I understand of Jawad Nabulsi's initiative, he has Jawad Nabulsi is an Egyptian who has an initiative called Nibni, is that he's working in a specific geographic area trying to promote various developmental projects. There's quite a difference between what we're doing, because some of the work that he's doing, to my understanding, definitely wouldn't fit your definition of entrepreneurship. Although some stuff, that's okay. Well, like I said, I don't want to speak for Jawad. The difference is that he's definitely from the get-go trying to do some public-private partnership, and some of the obstacles that I think he's felt and found has been, in delays working with governments that keep changing. And I think one of the strengths that Rise Egypt is built upon is that it is a people-to-people, people-driven solution. And so essentially what we are launching with are three programs. One called Rise Connect, which essentially will be direct capacity building between Egyptians in the diaspora and those who are interested in supporting through business development, capacity building, mentorship, advice, not money exchanges. It is professional knowledge exchanges with social entrepreneurs on the ground in Egypt. So we're building an online platform and offline opportunities for those exchanges to happen. That's the first. The second is a fellowship program, which is sort of our flagship program, will be a two-year fellowship to take social entrepreneurs from who have proven concept through quite a bit of acceleration in specific areas. So one is in social impact measurement and sciences, really getting people to understand how they think about and understand and make decisions around social impact and social return, so that they can actually show that to investors. The second is in financial financial models and really improving people's opportunities for revenue stream and thinking creatively about how some of these can be in fact social businesses, and so getting to the business side and the business training component. The third is on policy and advocacy, and really thinking about how to improve the ecosystem, whether they be legal or otherwise, to support these social entrepreneurs, and then lastly getting them trained to pitch to investors. And then along the way, also doing the ongoing just sort of mentorship support. And the reason why it's a two-year fellowship program is because we recognize that there's a long way to go and that people really deserve sort of a depth, an in-depth program. And lastly, RISE Research is really about thinking, taking a long-term view, and developing research and white papers that can be available to inform us as an organization about how better to invest, but also others in the ecosystem. And so we're looking at how to utilize measurement tools like the Social Progress Index, or the GEM reports, which are the Global Entrepreneurship Monitor, is published every couple of years through Babson University. They collect data on, I don't know how many countries now around the world, and Egypt is one of them. There are indicators that are followed on a regular basis. How can we track those sort of national level indicators and then drill down even at the governorate level and even locally at the neighborhood level to start to think about, can we expand the space for entrepreneurship and then investing in entrepreneurship, people-driven development solutions? Is it making any difference? Is it making any impact? And can we then track social development against economic development and see, are these things moving hand in hand or not? These are tricky things. And so one of the things that we'd also like to do is change the culture around research by making our data available, by making our, processes for and methodologies for analyzing our data available. We really want to sort of move the bar on thinking strategically. But I think that we won't come across the same problems that Jawed has come across because we are, again, a people-to-people initiative. We think a lot can be done, and a lot needs to be done sort of outside of the public sector.
Jim, any reaction to add to that?
I would just respond on...
Lift your mic, if you could.
So I would just respond on two areas. One, I thought to myself, I have been investing for 50 years now. At the worst of moments, when it was hopeless, in New York in 1975, New York, people were writing it off. Markets were dreadful. The crash of 87, the Asian crisis of the late 1990s, the Mexican crisis and so forth. It's always when people get depressed and are pessimistic that there are great opportunities. It usually comes about when funding comes in, and sometimes you don't know who's going to trigger it, but there's no question in my mind that Egypt has got all the basic foundation to attract very significant capital, and with the youthful population that we've talked about already, and with technology as it is, I have no doubt that 5 years from now, people will say, why didn't we invest in that area? Now, even on the water area, a lot of smart people are working on that subject right now. And as I listen to them, because WRI has really been studying that very closely, I leave thinking to myself, I should really be focusing the Enterprise Fund on renewables, which you would like to hear, on solar and on water. There are great opportunities. So that's why I'm optimistic. But I'd come back to one thing, and that is that I didn't maybe make a point on before. The world recognizes that SMEs account for most of the job creation. In Egypt, maybe it's more than 85% of new jobs are created by the SME world. So now we have to find a way to stimulate the SMEs so we can provide funding for them. And that's why the Enterprise Fund was created. I didn't make enough of an issue of that initially. So our goal is not to invest in marketable securities. We don't want to help make CIB bigger, or even Jahina do even better. Our goal is to try to help the smaller enterprises. And also, we have a bit of a dual bottom line. We would like to create more opportunities for women and minorities in Egypt. We actually have a measurement. The USAID has done a very good job of making us realize how important it is. So the measurement of success for the management and for the board will be that we can show reasonable, not great returns, but reasonable returns, create jobs, and jobs where they haven't been created. I would love to be able to say to you in 3 or 4 years, this is the number of new positions that were created, and umpteen percent were for women, and umpteen percent for minority. It can be done. There's no doubt about it. In fact, just a little known fact, I realized that in the countries we were investing in my day job, wherever women played a critical role, their markets did better.
Yeah.
In Rwanda, everybody's surprised, they have the largest number of women in parliament. We have made more money in a few different positions in Rwanda. But I started saying, let's study this closely. How do we make this point? Now, that doesn't mean that the Middle East will suddenly change for that reason. But there's good reason why we should be able to find ways to help SMEs and help women and minority members get jobs in addition to or concurrent with making money.
This is a huge point. In fact, The Economist said this summer that of all the tech startups in the Arab world, over 25% are women. And by the way, you'll never find that in Silicon Valley. So keep that in mind. There were a lot of questions over here. Sir, if I could.
Thank you. I'm Ahmed Adin Ahmed with the Internet of Freedom Institute, and my question is for Adina. You pointed out the difficulties of educational entrepreneurs who, because they remain in the nonprofit mode, are difficult to scale up. But my question is, well, what about the model that has been used successfully by some American universities of getting a culture of loyalty and gratitude in the alumni of the programs who, because their success is tied to the education they received, then become donors to the endowments of those organizations? Is this something that is possible to do as part of your educational program?
I think that this issue of using alumni to support educational institutions that exist in the U.S. is definitely something that we should work on. The issue that I was talking about specifically with regards to nonprofits and their ability to scale has a lot to do with just the mentality of NGOs and the frameworks that govern NGOs in Egypt that make it very difficult for them to grow and expand, because the government is so involved in every last penny that they spend and every last penny that they raise. And I think that that becomes makes it very difficult for them to grow in the way that they may want to grow. I don't think raising money is necessarily a problem. I think it's like Mona said, there's a lot of giving in Egypt. We have a very big culture of giving, specifically citizen-to-citizen giving, and if you're a credible organization, I don't think it's that difficult to raise money if you're creative and innovative for a nonprofit organization. I just think it's more about the mentality that exists with regards to scalability, because in the nonprofit sector, you're not allowed to hire the top talent because you can't pay them the salaries that they would want to stay in the nonprofit sector. You can't do huge marketing campaigns about a particular cause because that's also not allowed. It's similar in the U.S. But as a company, all of that is up for grabs. So I think a lot of people are moving towards the private sector because there's a lot more space. It's a lot more malleable, easier to maneuver. But I don't think that there's a problem in raising capital if somebody is creatively doing it. There is a huge culture of giving.
We have a lot of questions, so we'll try to go quick questions and quick answers. In the back of the room, please. There's a mic coming just to you.
Gotcha. My name is Ahmed Zivzaf. I'm an intern at the Wilson Center. First off, I'd just like to thank you all for being here and serving as an inspiration for young Egyptian Americans. My question is about that role of Egyptian Americans in the United States or other Americans who are currently interested in entrepreneurship in Egypt. What do you think our role is, and how best can we get involved towards the efforts that you guys have already considerably made in this topic?
You know, Mona, it's intrigued me how in the last two decades, for example, the Indian community has done an amazing job of integrating with diaspora here, both for business and social reasons, everything else. But this question is tailor-made for you. What can we do to light up the community here, and what are the things that you think are most powerful in this way?
Thank you for the question. We are actually leading an initiative called the Brain Gain Initiative. And what we would like to do, so there are several opportunities, and we'd like to really provide opportunities at several layers in the diaspora community. So the Brain Gain Initiative is meant to be a database where we will recruit those who are interested in providing support, capacity building support for the social entrepreneurs, or being a part of these meaningful exchanges to work with us. And so one thing you can do is sign in to being a part of the Brain Gain Initiative in the database. And the second thing is specifically for college students and you know, young professionals who may have are sort of just starting their careers, we will be implementing graduate student research fellowships and eventually service learning opportunities as well, because we think it's really important to you know, when I was in I went to University of Virginia undergraduate, and when I was looking to do service learning opportunities there globally, there were literally almost nothing in the Middle East. At the time, there was something in Morocco, one thing in Jordan, very, very few opportunities, and none in Egypt. So we'd like to really, and that space is definitely growing now, and we would like we will be building the opportunities for that. So I would say stay connected to us, and please meet me after. Huh?
Rest 100.
No. And thank you for the question.
Other questions as well? Please.
Thank you very much. Kathleen Hewlett from the Migration Policy Institute. Sina, you mentioned a convergence between civic engagement and entrepreneurship in Egypt. And I wondered if, looking forward a bit, if young entrepreneurs are successful beyond your wildest dreams in this really sector, this sector really grows, is there a potential for a clash between civically engaged entrepreneurs and the government, or established business interests?
I think there's only potential for a clash if they become political. But most of these entrepreneurs that I'm referring to are ones that just want to create a better future for their country through their businesses. So I think that clash is only if they're in direct conflict with the government or of that sort. But otherwise, no, I don't see a clash. I actually think the government embracing them, because these are people who will be solving major challenges that the government is not solving. Like renewable energy or traffic or healthcare or education. The government just doesn't have the means. So the more businesses you have doing that, the better.
We have a question in the front here, I think. Did you want to ask one?
Hi, my name is Priya Vitani. I'm with the Department of State. Thank you all for being here today. I actually had a similar question. There was an article last week in Foreign Policy that said Egypt's new leaders hate entrepreneurship based on...
The headline said that. The article did not so much.
Do Egypt's new leaders hate entrepreneurship based on changes in the constitution and past raids? So I was just wondering if you all could speak to kind of the role that the Egyptian government, either in the past and also now, can and should be, you know, what role they have been playing either in supporting or kind of serving as an obstacle to entrepreneurship endeavors, and what the role is that they should be playing.
This is Mohammed's piece. It's a great piece.
So can you repeat the question, Chris?
Yeah, so I don't know if you heard the question. Mohammed, how do you pronounce his last name so I don't blow his
name? I haven't read this piece.
But it's...
But I have an answer for that, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you think the government hates you?
There's this amazing
for that
piece whose headline actually was not really what the article said, though it was an amazing, powerful piece, which was, is government, in fact, hate entrepreneurs in Egypt in particular? And so, pronounce his name again.
Mohammed Dehshin.
Yeah, who's an amazing, thoughtful...
Former Harvard grad, doing really interesting work.
So I wouldn't say that the government hates entrepreneurs, but, I mean, for us, when we started the company, we really thought about working independently from the government, because we don't find that the government makes things easier. That's the problem. The government should facilitate things, but actually one of you, I'm sure you guys touched upon infrastructure challenges. One of the main challenges that we face, and I'm sure a lot of startup companies face, is regulation and legal, the legal framework. The government's regulations, it's a maze. It's very difficult to operate. It's so easy in Egypt to start a company. It's actually, you just need 5 days in Cairo and you have a company. But after that, that's what's difficult. Knowing what permits you need in order to operate. in regards to solar energy, there's so much government incentive. You pay a maximum of 2% customs on whatever you import if you're doing a solar energy project. But it's apparently a ministerial decree, something I don't even know what that means. But when you're starting, you really don't know these things. And as a startup, you don't have these resources. So you don't know how to take advantage of these incentive schemes. So there's lack of transparency. And I think this is actually a major challenge. It's just once you start your company, beyond that. That's why a lot of startup companies probably at the end shut down. It's just not, it's not very easy to operate.
So do governments hate, Dina, entrepreneurship? That sounds pretty hateful.
Yeah.
I think that the... Yeah, it's such a hard question.
Hate is a strong word.
I think there's a lack of understanding because I think the government itself needs to become a lot more entrepreneurial. I don't think there's a they don't celebrate these young startups, and nor do they even celebrate the SMEs that exist to what Jim is trying to do. They make life difficult for them. So as Yumna said, really for ahead of the curve, we were registered in 3 days. It was easy peasy, nothing to that. But everything after that is an obstacle. The other thing is, I think, you know, the government, so I'm not trying to be pessimistic, I'm very optimistic, but I think lately, probably Chris is frustrated because I tend to
You're jet lagged.
I tend to be a little bit of on the realistic, pessimistic side these days. I think there's a lot that needs to be done when it comes to providing an enabling environment for entrepreneurship. And when I say entrepreneurship, I mean everything from startups to the growth of SMEs, from small to medium to large businesses where they can be competitive, where they can grow. So I think there's a lot that needs to be done in terms of research. There's a dearth of information, a dearth of data. I don't think there's anywhere where a young Egyptian who wants to start a business could go and find in just one place all the sources of capital that they could tap into. I think there isn't one place where they could go to find out what training, what mentorship. So I think there's a lot that has to be done in terms
of Rise Egypt
or what we're doing or what's
Jim, I'm wondering if you could give a global perspective, because I'm going to say something that may be wrong, but I'd be curious. If I had to sue someone to get restitution as a businessman, I think I'd probably have a better shot in Cairo than I would in Beijing. But I don't know. But I just know the rule of law there is terrible and it's very hard to navigate. You have had to navigate legal codes. And let's take as a premise that the rule of law opportunities are enormous throughout the Middle East, and Egypt is certainly that case. But is this also just kind of part and parcel of what it means to be navigating emerging growth markets?
Well, most of my life I've spent in larger institutions, whether it was an investment banking firm or the U.S. Exim Bank. It's only the last 10 years that I ran a smaller company that grew that I could appreciate how difficult it is to build a small business. We have lots of regulatory aspects in the United States. And when you show up the first day and you realize you've got to get a little stationary, you have to get your all the little things that all of us were spoiled about in a bigger company, if you worked at Carnegie or wherever you might work, it's done for you. So when you suddenly start a business yourself, you don't know that. If I knew everything it was just to create the fund I did, I don't know whether I would have created it.
Now, in the U.S.?
In the U.S., nevertheless. So that's my point. Of course, now I look back and I say, wow, I'm glad I did it. But the fact is that it was tedious and difficult, even in the U.S. Now, if you go to the developing world, you can imagine, without deep pockets, the struggle that you have in every developing country, and the more the earlier it is, the more frontier it is, the more difficult it is. So the problem that you're referring to in Egypt is true in many, many other countries. And in some countries, they have even made it difficult. There are, of course, we call league tables that a lot of people read and put out by NGO World, is difficulty doing business in different countries, difficulty of organizing, and you can show. And some, I always tell, part of my job, frankly, at the Enterprise Fund is to try to get the Egyptian government to make reforms that makes it easier to open businesses, makes it easier for small businesses to grow. And so the goal was always to, one, help create jobs. And after we the U.S.-funded effort
created jobs, then our opportunity to help the government may be to recognize how to do some of those things. But it's not, again, rocket scientists. You can do it, but it's tedious. Most governments, including the United States, is quite bureaucratic. So you go in and say, I have a small business, I want you to help me. Who do you talk to? I mean, it is a task. And if I couldn't call up my friends, you know, at the embassy, or now I have friends in the government, I would be lost. So not an easy thing to do, but it can be done. Now, I would say that there are some NGOs and some people who actually are focusing on this area and do some very good work all over, including a start at Egypt. But anybody who thinks that in one moment you're going to change a bureaucracy of the history in a country and suddenly it's going to be easier, it comes down to, fortunately, when you're young, you have the energy and the desire and the hope and all the other things that you're going to wrestle those things. Years later, you worry about, do you have enough time to get that done? But I'm a bit confident that the young in Egypt, for example, will gradually work their way through. And with others like us and others in the United States, quietly we can move the government towards some reforms that will make it helpful. But it is a tough task.
We have time for maybe two more. So, please.
Mario Crippo from the Department. Sure, thanks. Mario Crippo from the Department of State. So just piggybacking on the last question, State Department, USAID, and the U.S. government more broadly have a number of programs aimed at addressing some of these ecosystem issues, regulatory reform issues, education reform, mentorship, these kinds of things. So I wonder if you could comment on those programs, perhaps provide a little bit of an assessment on how successful those programs are and whether they're headed in the right direction.
Very specifically, if I had asked each one of you, and Jim, I'll start with you just because you've got the American perspective, but any of you, if there's just one thing that you wished that the U.S. government, you got the U.S. government sitting here, if there's one thing that you wish they understood that they may not understand, I'd love to get your quick reaction to that in this particular way. But Jim, anything just on your perspective?
Not a direct answer to you, but I can't help but say a lot of very good people work in the United States government, in State Department, USAID, and Treasury and so forth, and don't really get credit for the good things they do. We, the American population, tend to be critical of the U.S. government all over, and not to mention other countries, of course, but we are such a giant in the world that it's only natural people would scold us constantly. So I kind of feel every time I'm working with them that I don't think that the people say the State Department people get appropriate recognition for the very good work. I mean, I'm talking now at a different level. I'm not talking about the secretary. So that's one comment to make. Second comment is not easy what you're trying to do. I don't want to take even a moment to tell any government department today what they should be doing differently. I could make some comments about what the Congress should do differently. That would be easy and I think could make life a lot easier. But the executive branch, I think they do a pretty good job and it's a hard thing to do.
Yuma, anything?
I don't want to sound arrogant or anything, but for us, it's irrelevant. We don't really think about what the U.S. can do for us or what the international community can do for us. But the only thing I can think about is more collaboration, partnership. I mean, one of our partners is a U.S. company. So, I mean, I don't see it in terms of support. I'd much rather see more of collaboration. In regards to the international community, we like them, but yeah, that's not our model of how we do things.
They're doing it anyway, right, Dina?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But I do have I think if the only thing I would say about USAID is it's just too complicated. So I think there are so many opportunities where many might want to collaborate with USAID, but just the process is so complicated and weighed down with paperwork that people just say, I can't be bothered. You know, it's a very difficult process, and I don't think enough people know how to make use of these programs in a way that is simple and easy. So
there is one thing else I would add.
But
the complicated thing reminds me. It used to always bother me at the Ex-Im Bank. To apply for support on an export to a developing country, you had to fill out, a small company in the United States had to fill out a form that was about 40 pages long. And when I first looked at it, I said, wow, no wonder small companies don't want to do it. They couldn't possibly understand it.
I was filling out that form, and I didn't understand it.
So I went to the OMB, and to try to negotiate with the OMB, a lot of very good people there, a change in a form from being 30 pages. Why don't we do it on the internet, I said to him, where they just bango, send it to us, we'll give them a response. Well, that I didn't have enough years left at the Ex-Im Bank to do that. So even our government is very bureaucratic. Yeah. You have to sort of stay the course. So I'm very understanding. You can imagine on the developing world. By the way, I think that my guess is that what we're trying to do, the Ex-Im Bank hasn't done enough, in my opinion, in Egypt. It does only large transactions for pipelines or for aircraft. And we used to do a lot of small transactions. And we grew the business at Ex-Im Bank for sub-Saharan Africa from a modest $40 million when I first got there to over $1 billion last year, only because we were focused on that area. So that would be very helpful to providing. That means providing small and middle-sized companies in Egypt to buy a piece of equipment or services if they need it from an export credit agency like Ex-Im. But I have proposed, which we will get some of the day, other export credit agencies, not just Ex-Im, there are 85 of them, to create a program in the Middle East, and Egypt specifically, where small and middle-sized companies could buy what they want from the country that they wanted to buy it, and it would be financed over a long period of time at a very low cost. And
I can tell you what was our problem with that. Actually, we did apply for a loan from the Ex-Im Bank before, and they do have something called Express Solar Loan. I can't remember the title, but you get the point. It's supposed to be fast. But the problem was we were a startup company, and we did not have the financial track record that will enable us to get a loan from them. So that was one of the challenges. We're not bankable. So we were, and it's true, we're a startup company. We didn't have much to show, but I mean, in terms of that, maybe, yeah, you could focus more on tailoring a specific program for small, medium-sized. Yeah,
someday, I'll go back on television in Egypt, and I'm going to say what you just said was, small, middle-sized companies that want to get financing from export credit agencies, they should make a note of my email, and then I've got to hire some people to respond, but it can get done if you can help them. We could nurse them into a position where they could do a lot of funding would be available, not just from the United States. It's important that we don't look like we're the ones who are benefiting by other countries.
Mm-hmm. If you remember me for nothing else, because I promise to keep us on schedule here, so I'll do that, but if you remember me for nothing else, the bottom up wants simplicity, no friction. And this is not about huge amounts of money dropped top down, but it's a light flexibility to help little amounts of money that can go a long way. And that, I think, is one of the great messages that these folks have articulated so beautifully. And you guys have articulated so much so beautifully. It's just wonderful to spend time with you and to have this amazing insight, which I'll bet was very, very new to a lot of the people here in the audience. So if I could ask you to thank this amazing group, it's just wonderful. Kate, any last words from your perspective?
No, I just want to once again thank this incredible group for coming. It's as somebody in the back said, you're a model and an inspiration for so many, both in Egypt and outside.
Great. Thank you all.